welcome back to the Anarcho Book Club. So today we're going to talk about a book that I have put off reading for a couple of years now, but let me pull it up real quick. But it is a book that it was small enough, it was a good first project to start editing, and I edited the book, I reformatted it, so we should have our first publication by the Anarcho Book Club. Let me pull it up here. Oh, where'd it go? There it is. It's called Agorist Class Theory. Let's see. Now, I've noticed some of the formatting is a little bit weird still, so I'm still kind of working on it, but it's good enough that it's easy to read. I've got plenty of little... I marked chapters, different chapters, according to the different sections. This book doesn't really have chapters, so to speak. It has a lot of little sections, but I went ahead and marked them just so it's easy to kind of thumb through it on your e-reader or whatever you use to read EPUB files. But let's see. Table of contents. It's got a whole table of contents. It's real nice. I really enjoyed doing it, but this is the first of many, I hope, that we do. But this is what we read. I'm hoping you guys picked it up on the website. If you haven't, go ahead. You can pause this episode. Go pick it up real quick at Anarcho Book Club or anarchobook.club. It's in the library section under Samuel Edward Konkin III. And if you guys have followed me on Mastodon, I've kind of mentioned a few things about him. He's kind of a weird dude, to be honest with you. You look him up, and there's not a lot about him. But, and his ideas, he writes a lot like some of the other anarchists we've read, or that I've read. I haven't covered as many as I have read, but he writes kind of not very provocatively, but he writes fairly provocatively. He makes a lot of statements that he thinks are 100% accurate, and he writes so that you think so, or that he wants you to think so as well. But overall, he has some good ideas. Now, he is an agorist. So an agorist, it really depends on who you ask about an agorist, what an agorist is. Samuel Edward Konkin III, I believe he's the one who coined the term, and therefore you might be able to say, is the father of agorism. Let me see. Actually, let me pull up my notes real quick, because I have a few notes on this. Well, if I can get my mouse to work. Hold on, I'm going to pause real quick. Okay, so apparently I don't know where I put my notes, but that's okay. We'll just, let me pull it up again. So, agorism. Agorism is a form of anarchy. Let's see what Wikipedia says about it. Agorism is a social philosophy that advocates creating a society in which all relations between people are voluntary exchanges by means of counter-economics, engaging with aspects of peaceful revolution. The agorist philosophy kind of takes, this is me again, the agorist philosophy kind of takes the, it takes parts from anarcho-capitalism a little bit, but you know, and that's kind of what, it's a voluntarist is what they call themselves sometimes. But even voluntarists are different from agorists. Agorists are an activist community. They create their own little marketplaces, so to speak, amongst themselves. They'll trade for cash, or right now at least, in the agorist community, Bitcoin is a huge thing. They focus a lot more on peaceful revolution against whatever it is, the powers that be, so on and so forth. It is part of the libertarian tradition. In fact, Konkin, the author... In fact, actually, hold on. Let me just talk about the book real quick. Konkin is not the author of this book. It's Wally Conger. But It is kind of a compilation of Konkin's unfinished works, and then Conger has his own additions that he puts in. So, but I thought it was one of the better works that we could kind of get an insight into Konkin's brain, so to speak. excuse me. So, an agorist, which is Konkin and Conger, an agorist engages in a, just so you have a little bit of background, they aren't like the anarcho-capitalists who see the world as a grand economy, so to speak. That's not, it's all about perspective. An agorist, for instance, let's say I'm an agorist. I live in a neighborhood. I'm not going to Walmart to buy everything that I need. I mean, I could, but because, again, it's a voluntary exchange. But even then, buying things at Walmart, an agorist would say that's not exactly voluntary exchange. Because Walmart profits heavily from the taxation, the involuntary taxation of citizens. Walmart benefits from involuntary price controls and wage slavery. And yes, that does come straight from the agorist tradition, wage slavery. The agorist also, so the agorist will try to create within his own little community, he'll get to know his neighbors, so to speak, or she, he or she will get to know their neighbor or neighbors. And any time that they can interact with each other in a communal effort, so to, it's a communal effort. So, for instance, I know about half of my neighbors. I don't know them all because most of them stay inside, especially these days. They stay inside away from everyone. But I know some neighbors. I know some neighbors I can go to and say, hey, I need something. I need, let's just use a generic example. I need a cup of sugar. That neighbor would gladly give me a cup of sugar. And it, unlike the anarcho-capitalists, this is not a exchange of goods for profit. So to, it's not. It's not an exchange of good for profit. I mean, it kind of is, if you really think about it. My neighbor gives me a cup of sugar, and he knows that he can rely on me for something that he needs in the future. And but it's not just that either. It's also, there's an element of mutualism to the agorist tradition, which, see, now there are a lot of anarcho-capitalists out there that believe, they say, oh, I'm an agorist and I believe in these things. But you mention the word mutualism or mutual exchange or whatever you want to call it, and they start thinking that you might be some sort of a anarcho-syndicalist or even just a straight-up communist. I've noticed this a lot in that community, and I don't want to get off on this tangent too far, but I just wanted to kind of distinguish what an agorist is. An agorist is simply, from what I can understand, a human being who doesn't think that his or her or their interactions with other human beings should be regulated in any way, as long as all parties agree and all parties are participating voluntarily. So, and then there's, of course, you have to define all of that as well, but we're not going to go into that because today we are talking about agorist class theory. So, the book starts out, let's just get onto it. The book starts out with Konkin's description of the failure of Marxism. And there is one distinct thing about Marxism that we can say was kind of a huge mistake on Karl Marx's part, and that is the calculation error. And it can't really be refuted that Marxism, if done exactly as Marx says, they run into a huge calculation error, which Ludwig von Mises outlines in his book called Socialism. So it's the idea that this calculation error idea is that if you follow Marx's plan to a T and you try to regulate an entire economy based on the social good and all the different things that you have to do, it fails to account for the calculation of what is needed. So they think they can the needs of a large community are so complex that to account for every need, it would take that entire community working together to figure that out. And it becomes a redundancy to have a Marxist form of government or a Marxist form of society. It becomes a redundancy to try to set up a system to figure that out when the society itself can automatically figure that out. And that's kind of what Mises and Konkin both explain. So, but that's not what he focuses on. That's just, he introduces the book with this, or at least Conger does. Wally Conger introduces the book with the failure of Marxism and the calculation problem, or problems of calculation. And he moves on to the appeal of Marxism. And it is an appeal that agorism shares. Because, well, let's just read what he wrote. Let me see here. Where is it? Let's see. What is Marxism's appeal? Well, Samuel Edward Konkin III wrote, "The most appealing part of Marxism may well have been the vision of socio-political revolution as a secular apocalypse. While others offered explanations of revolution, only Marx gave it such meaning. No longer were the oppressed to merely oust the old regime, to bring in a new regime brutal in a slightly different way, but the revolution would make things so great that no further revolution was necessary." Marx's I don't know how to say it. It's a French word. Sorry. And here I started this whole thing saying that I think I can pronounce these words. Let's see. Légèrement demain was, it looks like légère demain. Anyway, so was actually profoundly conservative. Once the revolution was over, there would be no more. Even diehard monarchists flinched from that much stasis. Yet the combination was unbeatable to motivate political activists. One all-out effort and then home free. More realistic presentations of revolution tended to excite less dedication and commitment. So, excuse me, I've got a scratchy throat today again. So, the appeal of Marxism was this idea that there's one revolution to end them all, according to Konkin. One revolution to end them all. One revolution to take away the power from the elite and give it to the so-called new elite, which would be the proletariat. And then, so Konkin further explains this. Agorism and Marxism agree on the following premise. Human society can be divided into at least two classes. One class is characterized by its control of the state and its extraction of unearned wealth from the other class. Furthermore, agorists and Marxists will often point to the same people as members of the overclass and underclass, especially agreeing on what each considers the most blatant cases. The differences arise as one moves to the middle of the social pyramid. Agorists and Marxists perceive a class struggle which must continue until a climactic event which will resolve the conflict. Both sides perceive select groups which will lead the victims against their oppressors. The Marxists call these groups of high-class consciousness vanguards, and then extract even more aware elements designated elites of the vanguard. And this is me again. This is actually the classic problem of the vanguard class, because the vanguard class eventually becomes what the Marxist revolutionaries fought against. But anyway, on with it. Agorists perceive a spectrum of consciousness amongst the victims as well, and also perceive the most aware elements as the first recruits for the revolutionary cadre, with the exception of intellectuals. The Marxists and agorists sharply disagree on who these most progressive elements are. And that is, so, historically at least, and this is, I think, what Konkin is drawing on, historically, what we've seen, the Marxists elevate select members of their, or select groups of people to a, based on how their class consciousness and so on, to a higher realm. Whereas agorists, everyone fights in it together, and the only thing fights against whatever it is together. And the only thing that really separates you is if you were a first recruit or someone within already recruited you, so to speak. So it was, there's no real upper class, lower class within the agorist tradition. However, with Marxists, as we've seen through history, and you can, I'm not here to judge one way or another, but as we've seen in historical examples, Marxism starts out great. The proletariat rise up, they beat down the ones that are keeping them in slavery, and they take over. But at that point, the upper classes within their own ranks rise to the top and do exactly what they were, they become exactly what they fought against. And that's the problem that I think Konkin is specifically identifying here. Then Konkin goes on to explain class theory within the Marxist tradition, which I have to say, within this book he does leave out quite a bit. Like, and maybe it was the times that he was writing it. I believe this was written in the 80s. Maybe the 90s. But either way, the times he was writing it, he may have not been as aware of certain traditions in Marxism, especially modern Marxism. And then he goes through the actual different classes within Marx, within Marxism. And, well, here, I'll just read a little bit of what he said. Let me get a drink of water real quick. Okay. Oh, that made it worse. Okay. The old order was making way for a new one. The aristocracy was on its way out, either to liquidation, as in France and in the U.S., or to vestigial status, kept around for ceremonial purposes by a sentimental bourgeoisie and lower classes, as in England. The bourgeoisie was in the ascendancy in the first half of the 19th century. Marx's formative and most active years. Future events could and were explained by this class struggle theory. The Europe-wide rebellion of 1848 swept away much of aristocratic power restored after Napoleon's defeat. The American Civil War was the northern bourgeoisie's way of smashing the remnant of landed aristocracy preserved as by the South. Preserved that? Okay. Some of the way he writes is a little bit odd. It's hard for me to parse aloud. Continuing, while this phenomenon so far was widely acknowledged, though it applied poorly to the Franco-Prussian War of 1870 through 71, Marx was as interested in the transformation of the lower class as in that of the upper class. Peasants were being driven off their farms. Serfs were given their freedom to go to the cities to become industrial workers. And here was the focus of Marx's insight. So it was basically a whole jumble of classes. The classes around the world got shook up, so to speak, and according to Konkin. And I think that it bears out if you read through history. Things did shake up a lot, and a lot of it was due to the spread of Marxism and the ideas of Marxism. So he goes through all of that and kind of sets the stage. Wally Conger also goes into the what he calls the agorist critique of Marxist class theory, and he goes through and critiques Marxist class theory, showing positives, which he actually found a few positives, but which you know if you've read it, but because whenever I read agorist writings. It's a kind of like a flip of a coin if it's actually just a anarcho-capitalist in agorist clothing or not. I, for instance, I identify quite a bit with the actual foundational theories of agorism. I really enjoy a lot of their community building and the mutual aid sections of their philosophy. I really enjoy a lot of their ideas and a lot of their philosophies. But I don't know if I would call myself a... I don't think a lot of agorists... I'll put it this way. I don't think a lot of agorists would necessarily identify me with them, so to speak. I love, though, the one thing about agorism that really gets me is the whole idea of counter-economics. You work against the system rather than being helplessly trapped within the system. So, well, for instance, I have a job. That's working within the system. But I also buy a lot of things, or I don't buy a lot of things, but whenever I need something, I try as hard as I can to buy it with cash or to buy it from an individual. Like my computers, the different computers I have, I've only purchased one from an actual corporation. The rest of them I've purchased secondhand or from friends of mine. And it's this kind of thing that I know it seems small, but if everyone did just that, it would undermine the entire economy to the point that it would effectively take away the powers of the massive corporations that we are being forced to serve. In the same way, and I think this applies to agorism, even though we didn't have this back in whenever Konkin was alive, but in the same way, I use only open source and free software. I say it that way because some of the software I use isn't entirely free, as defined by the GNU project, but it is all open source. It is, and I take it freely and donate voluntarily to the projects. And I think that is a huge part that falls in line. But here's the thing. It falls in line not just with agorism, but it would fall in line with the anarcho-syndicalists, the straight-up anarchist, black and red flag anarchists. It falls in line with most of the anarchist traditions. The only ones that I know do not fall in line with this are the anarcho-capitalists. They tend to see, at least the ones I know, tend to... they don't quite idolize corporations, but they put a lot of trust, we'll put it that way, in corporations. A lot of trust that I never would even consider putting, even if I weren't an anarchist at all. So But that's where, so that's where I kind of stand with agorism. And he goes in more into this book. I wanted to really cover his critiques and similarities of agorism to Marxism. And then he finally arrives at agorist class theory. After all of those pages, we finally get to what is agorist class theory. And in which he kind of discusses everything I've sort of discussed. I'll just read a little bit of it real quick. Since many libertarians arrived at anarchy from the limited government, classical liberal position, they retain a sort of three-cornered concept of the struggle. The state at one apex, real criminals at the second, and innocent society at the third. Those who commit victimless crimes, in the minarchist view, may often be put in the criminal class not for their non-crime victimless act, but for avoiding trial by the state and remaining at large. Again, some anarchists have yet to entirely free themselves from this liberal statist hangover. Remember, the liberal statists want to restrain the state to increase the production of the host, to maximize eventual parasitism. I don't think I said that right. They control their appetites, but continue the system of plunder. The recent political example of supply-side economics starkly illustrates the basic statist nature of such ideas. The tax rate is lowered in order to encourage greater economic production, and thus a greater total tax collection in the long run. So he's talking about here the quote-unquote fake anarchists. And a lot of people consider, and I think I would even consider the anarcho-capitalists to be something of just, I don't know, they're weird. I'll full disclosure, I started out that way. That's where I came from. And the more I understood about anarchism and just the moral concepts that have caused me to realize that the state is, in fact, evil, that the state itself is just an oppressive force. And the more I realize, and here's the thing, the more I realize, and agorism kind of brought me to this as well, the more I realize that the state is nothing but just another corporation, and it always has been. There has never been a state that wasn't just another corporation. Because if you think about what it does, what the state itself does, just think about it. And it's regardless of where you are. They take over, they've always had, the power over an industry. Let's just use healthcare, because I think all over the world, the state is in complete or almost complete control of healthcare. Even here in the United States, they have been since, I don't know, the 40s, I think, or 50s. They've been in complete control, but then they go and blame it on everybody else anytime there's a problem. And it's their own damn fault. So let's just take healthcare. This is something that if the state had nothing to do with it, sure, at first, if you just think of it from today's terms, reality terms, at first, say the state evacuated all of the hospitals and they said, do what you will, we aren't touching this anymore. At first, there would be complete chaos. There would be, and that's true. But eventually, you would, for instance, this is a classic Murray Rothbard, or Rothbardianism, so to speak. For instance, back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, it took a while for him to basically ban the ideas of holistic medicine. Holistic medicine meaning treating the entire body rather than just the symptoms. That is kind of... Well, no, it is banned in a way. It's not banned as in you can't do this ever. It's banned as in if you practice this, you're not going to get a license. And licensing, of course, is a state. If you think about it, everything you do has state involvement. But let me try to stay on track here. So, back, way back in the United States, you had the two class. You had the people that practiced holistic medicine, and you had the people who practiced, what was it called? It's basically a targeted approach to medicine, where you attack the actual symptoms until the symptoms go away, and until you think the person is cured. Eventually, some man rose up in the ranks of government, and I wish I should have looked this up before, but I didn't think about it. A guy rose up in ranks of government, and he decided to centralize all control of learning about medicine in just a few universities. And to this day, those universities have to sign off on the issuance of medical degrees. And those universities, it's centralized power. An agorist is against centralizing power of any form. An agorist is against centralization entirely. So are most anarchists, I think. But maybe not the anarcho-capitalists. So they centralized the power to make all of these decisions. And eventually they decided that if you practiced holistic medicine and taking small doses of something to slowly improve your body's function or whatever it is that needs to happen, that's not okay, according to them. And so just by centralizing power, they're able to eradicate and delegitimize the whole practice of a holistic medicine. Now, holistic medicine is seen as something, it's kind of like witchcraft almost. Like, I don't know where I'm at, I don't know where you're at, but where I'm at, you go into a shop that sells holistic remedies. First off, you don't know if half of them work, and you walk in and there's crystals hanging from the ceiling and shelves stuffed with all kinds of different herbs. Ours is called Herbs and Heirlooms. They sell books about Wiccanism or Wiccans, and I don't know what it's actually called, but I know that's what they call themselves. They sell books on magic and demonology and everything. So it looks very fantastical. But they also have actual holistic remedies. And I can't attest. My wife swears up and down that taking certain things at certain times helps, you know, whatever it is, like allergies or whatever it is. But that was all shut down almost 100 years ago, to where that can't even be researched, really. I mean, it could be. I mean, you could be free to do it, but good luck getting money to do that. Good luck getting any kind of economic power to do that at all. So, they centralize control and shut it down. And that is a classic example of how things could have worked. Had we been a more anarchist society back then, it never would have shut down. People would keep buying it and slowly buying into whatever it is. And slowly, you would figure out through a decentralized form of economic calculation, so to speak, you would figure out what works best. And you'll find out what works best because eventually people will stop using whatever it is. And by the way, so holistic medicine, there is a lot less risk in taking the wrong thing. So you can take this herb or that herb, and you might have an allergic reaction, and that would be terrible, but you're probably not going to. Most of the time you won't, in fact. There's very little risk. And I'm not saying it could be used for everything, but maybe it could. We don't know. We have no idea because they shut that all out, and you're not allowed to study that. Unless you do it on your own time and with your own money, you're not allowed to study it. And that's just one example of how government has affected our lives. It's everything. Everything you do, the government has had a hand in now. Especially in the United States. I don't know about all the other places in the world. I've only been to maybe 8 or 9 different countries, so I don't really know everywhere else, wherever you are. But if you think about it, it's probably still true. The government has had a hand in everything you do. And this is the appeal of Marxism. This is the appeal of agorism. Because you're overthrowing the vanguard, so to speak. You're overthrowing the upper classes and the people who control you and control everything you do. And you're dragging them down to your level, which is reality. It is reality for 99.99% of all people. You drag all of the others down to that level. And some traditions would have you, well, during the revolution, things happen. People could get killed, whatever. It's just, I know that sounds very flippant to say it that way, but it is what it is. And it's just, the differences, as far as this book has explained, are that the agorist is more of an anarchist than, and I know Marx was never an anarchist. He would not have liked to hear that his theories, I think, are being used in an anarchist tradition. But either way, so this book really outlines how all of that comes together and how it kind of gives you an insight. It's like a window into how agorist people, or the agorist, think life should be or would be under an anarchist or agoristic voluntarist regime, which is no regime at all, because all power would be decentralized, all things would be decentralized. I'm sure power could centralize a little bit, but, and maybe it would, but we would never know if we keep around the primacy of the state, supremacy of the state. And that's really what I got out of this book, to be honest with you. And there's a lot more to it, but this is kind of what I got out of it. And I hope this wasn't too terribly informal. If I hadn't lost my notes, I need to actually save them next time, probably, instead of just restarting my computer without saving, which I think is what happened. But that's what I need. Let's see. That's what I got out of this book. Sorry. Man, I'm very scatterbrained today. I must have not had enough coffee. Or too much. So go ahead and read it if you haven't. I can't say that I highly enjoyed this book. It was okay. It wasn't great. But hopefully it's a little bit more readable than it would have been as a PDF, which is the only way you can get it otherwise. And this at least will flow a little bit better. And I did a lot more, I didn't do any styling, but I put like quotes in block quote tags instead of just another paragraph tag. And so they kind of stand out a little bit more. But tell me what you think about this and about this book, and just kind of, just give me your ideas. You can find me at dobbs.town/@HERAG. Harag. That's a name I came up with myself. All right, that should be it for today. Thanks for listening, and hopefully, like I said last time, hopefully I'll be getting these episodes out more frequently, but we'll see.